This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And listen to this editorial. Quote, the potential strike by the United States against Syria, despite strong opposition from many countries and major political and religious leaders, including the Pope, will result in more innocent victims and escalation, potentially spreading the conflict far beyond Syria's borders. A strike would increase violence and unleash a new wave of terrorism. It could undermine multilateral efforts to resolve the Iranian nuclear problem and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and further destabilize the Middle East and North Africa. It could throw the entire system of international law and order out of balance. Now, while you're thinking about who made that statement, it's not from some Republican senator thinking about voting against a resolution on a U.S. military strike in Syria. Neither is it an impassioned call from an anti-war Democrat who believes President Obama has betrayed his principles by involving the U.S. in the Syrian civil war. It's from Russian leader Vladimir Putin in an op-ed piece for our partner, The New York Times. The statement maintains Putin's high profile in this controversy as the United Nations begins to put together a resolution that could control and destroy Syria's chemical weapons. With us on the line to discuss the piece is Stephen Lee Myers, Moscow bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Stephen, quite a step.
Yeah, and as you read in the passage, he doesn't hold back much. He makes his points very clear, a warning about the effects of a potential strike by the United States and others against Syria.
Now, he attempts deliberately to use some of the arguments that have already been used by some senators. Is there an additional message he's trying to deliver here?
You know, what I think is really striking about this is that, you know, Vladimir Putin doesn't make a lot of statements like this in op-eds for the New York Times. I actually looked, and the last time he wrote one was when he was prime minister in 1999 about the war in Chechnya. So it's rare for him. And he says at the very beginning that he feels like there hasn't been enough communication between the two countries and the two societies. And he took this occasion to explain himself directly to the American people through the pages of the New York Times editorial board.
And one of his arguments was that the fighters that we are ostensibly supporting are not fighting for democracy, most of them. He said this is not a battle for democracy. And he said that most of the fighters, as some U.S. senators have described, are in fact much more interested in a kind of jihadist agenda. Here's a response from a U.S. senator, Senator Robert Menendez, the head of the Foreign Relations Committee, on CNN last night.
I got an email with President Putin had to say, and I have to be honest, we had dinner, and I almost wanted to vomit. The reality is I worry when someone who came up to the KGB tells us what is in our national interest and what is not.
That's interesting to me in the sense that he's not really dealing with the argument. He's just saying, oh, he's a KGB guy. We don't have to listen to him.
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to point out that President Putin wasn't saying what was in the United States' national interest. He was saying very clearly what was in Russia's national interest. And in his mind, the most important issue, and he repeats it several times in this essay, is that all military interventions either have to be justified by self-defense or authorized by the United Nations Security Council, where, of course, Russia has a veto. And in his argument, in his view, the United States or other countries and coalitions intervening in conflicts around the world to overthrow governments is an unacceptable extension of power.
One of the things that I found most interesting is how he took on the president's call, and it's certainly not President Obama's exclusive kind of rhetoric, that America has an exceptionalist role to lead the world in some moral vision. He described this as fundamentally dangerous for the entire world.
You know, what's really interesting is I heard today that Putin wrote this himself in Russian. It was translated, obviously, and that he very much wanted to respond directly to the president's speech the other day. And as President Obama made clear, he feels like the United States has a special role in the world. And Vladimir Putin simply disagrees with that.
Finally, he says this that might have come from someone in Iowa. Who have been calling Congress people's offices really worried about the possibility of this intervention. Putin writes, it is alarming that military intervention in internal affairs in foreign countries has become commonplace for the United States. Is it in America's long-term interest? I doubt it.
You know, it's interesting that the reaction here in Moscow today, this has gotten a lot of attention locally because, you know, again, it's rare for him to do this, even in Russia, to write an essay like this. At the same time, I do believe that Putin's audience here was the world. He was trying to reach, as he said, to the American people and to American officials there as this debate unfolds.
Stephen Lee Myers, Moscow bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much, Stephen.
Thank you.
The Russians and the Americans will get to debate face-to-face in the Security Council as a resolution to control and possibly destroy Syrian chemical weapons under international supervision makes its way back to the Security Council table. With us is former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nancy Soderbergh. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you very much.
A couple of things. First, tell us a little bit about how this process is going to take place as they look at a different kind of resolution now that this chemical weapons international supervision issue is on the table. And any insights as to how Russia might vote based on that op-ed in The New York Times?
Well, it's going to be a very messy process. Having sat around that table up at the UN, there's going to be arguing about commas and quotes and where the dots and the I's are dotted and crossed. It's not a clear process at all. I think what's likely to emerge is a resolution authorizing the UN to go and inspect the chemical weapons of the Assad regime, and not much more. There's broad disagreement on the use of force, and when the permanent five members of the Security Council are divided, the UN is hamstrung. Similarly, in our U.S. Congress, I think they've hit the pause button on this issue. The football right now is focused on the chemical weapons debate, and I think what will happen is Assad will actually let the inspectors in. Whether he's going to be serious about that or not very much remains to be seen. But the big elephant in the room is not the chemical weapons. It's the ongoing civil war. This is a regime that's killed over 100,000 people without chemical weapons and hell-bent on doing it again. I think what the world is hoping is that the diplomacy over the chemical weapons will then lead to a diplomacy over a ceasefire and an ultimate resolution. There's no military solution here. The rebels aren't going to overthrow the government. The government's not going to crush the rebels. You've got proxy wars going on with Iran and Russia supporting the government, us and the Saudis supporting the opposition. And it's going to just go on until you can get a diplomatic solution. And that's the major issue. And I would not look to the UN to solve that.
So what is U.N. Ambassador, current U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power to do? She's made a very impassioned humanitarian case that there should be punishment for essentially a war crime by the Syrian regime on chemical weapons. Does she have to soften her rhetoric and get into a much more nuanced, languaged resolution that pretty much just says, let's keep taking a look at this?
Well, I think she needs to do both. She's a passionate advocate for humanitarian intervention, has been for decades, and is an extraordinary voice for that. And I think she's been an important voice within the administration for tough action. I think you have to remember, we would not be having the discussion about Syria handing over its chemical weapons had Obama not put the use of force on the table. And it's going to be a very delicate balance between the use of force and diplomacy. The two have to be married to end the civil war there. And I think we're beginning to see that process. You're not going to have anything clean. It's going to change. The Russians glamming on to Secretary Kerry's offhand remark, all of a sudden making the possibility of diplomacy real, is a positive step. It's the first positive thing the Russians have done in this conflict. And hopefully we can build on that. I'm not optimistic that the Syrians are going to genuinely hand over their weapons. You know, Ronald Reagan's trust but verify. In this case, you don't trust and you verify. This is a regime that a week ago said it didn't have chemical weapons, hadn't used them, lying blatantly. So nobody trusts them. So whether the Russians can actually deliver them is going to be the big test on the chemical weapons front. Whether Russia will be a constructive player in actually trying to bring an end to this civil war is going to be the bigger question going forward. And no one knows the answer to that yet.
We're talking with the former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nancy Soderbergh. Now, you know, accuse me of being a Mr. Positive Spinmeister here, but what you've just said might be an argument for some momentum going forward. Yes, a week ago they said they didn't have any chemical weapons. Now they say they do. A week ago, the Russians weren't even lifting a finger to do anything constructive here. Now there does appear to be a framework for some sort of U.S.-American partnership on something. That's got to be a first step diplomatically towards perhaps a wider treatment of the war itself.
Well, that's the big question. And having been through the wars on Kosovo and Bosnia and Haiti, when you're trying to negotiate an end to the war and you get a small diplomatic step forward, diplomats often mistake that for a momentum that's going to end the war. And it ends up not being that. You end up having to bring the use of force back into that regime. And that's into that equation. And that's what we don't know yet. Everyone is hoping that this diplomatic opening on the chemical weapons will then lead to a diplomatic opening to solve the war. There's no indication that that's the case so far. And that's the international community, the president, secretary of state, Samantha Power, Susan Rice, and the Europeans are going to have to continue to push that forward. My guess is we will have to bring force again to the table before this war is over. And the marriage of force and diplomacy has been key for the last 20 years in ending wars and conflicts. So whether this threat of the use of force by President Obama is sufficient to drive an end to the war is the key challenge ahead.
So then
chemical weapons is the current focus, but we must not lose sight of the broader civil war that's going on here, and how do we end that?
So you would rhetorically look for in this resolution some clause which suggests, and if none of the above takes place, then we're back to talking about force.
And you're not going to get that out of this Security Council with the Russians on there. I think you might get that out of the U.S. Congress, that if this fails, you will have a much broader support in the American people and in the Congress for a limited strike to degrade the capacity of this regime to do it. But there is no appetite for getting involved directly in overthrowing this regime. And I think if you get the chemical weapons done and the Syrians actually do hand that over, that's a good thing. But it doesn't solve the underlying conflict. The Syrian government is still attacking its people. So there's two routes here. One is that the Syrian government agrees to negotiate an end to this conflict with strong Russian support for that, or it spirals into a prolonged civil war where another 100,000 people die. We will try and build up the opposition. The government of Russia and Iran will continue to try and build up the government, and neither side is going to win, and the people will suffer. And that's we're in that fork in the road right now. Which one we'll take is very much an open question.
Nancy Soderberg, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
10 billion. That's the population of the world by the end of the century. What do you think about that?
Hi, this is Scott from Highland Park. I'm the oldest of four, but my parents are from families of 6 and 20, so my family is huge. I enjoy big families, but I won't have more than 2 kids myself. I believe it is irresponsible, based on environmental concerns, to have more than 2 children because of the pressures of overpopulation.
What do you think about the population and your own family planning? Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Stay with us. 5 years ago this Sunday, the bubble burst. Fears that the amount of debt in the economy had outstripped the available cash in the marketplace, combined with a suddenly dubious value of billions of dollars of the outstanding debt, exploded in the failure of financial services firm Lehman Brothers. Jeff Connaughton, did you see it coming?
Absolutely not. I thought we had in place a legal and a regulatory system that would prevent absolute catastrophes from happening, that there couldn't be such an event as that. But we were all wrong. The legal and regulatory system had completely eroded, and banks were doing things that not even Chairman Bernanke at the Fed or our other top regulators really had any idea were happening.
Jeff Connaughton is a former lobbyist, a White House lawyer, a Senate aide. He's the author of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. So, Jeff, it might be fair to say that what you were saying back in 2007 might have sounded a little bit like what James Gorman, the CEO of Morgan Stanley, said just the other day.
The probability of it happening again in our lifetime is as close to zero as I could imagine. The way these firms are managed, the amount of capital that they have, the amount of liquidity that they have, the changes in their business mix, it's dramatic. We have constant connections with our regulators about what we're doing across all of our businesses. The transparency of information that flows between those who regulate and those being regulated is tremendous.
So it's all fixed, right, Jeff?
Well, he'd be the last person whose word I would take for it. And it's preposterous that he would say that, because it was just last year that the Senate did extensive hearings into the J.P. Morgan London whale trading losses, which eventually amounted to $6 billion. And Jamie Dimon, the CEO, and others at the top of J.P. Morgan purported to have absolutely no knowledge of what was happening inside their own bank. So nothing has changed in the sense that we don't have the kind of transparency and the absolute knowledge of the systemic risks that might be building up within these banks, as that CEO just claimed. I mean, there's no doubt that the regulators are chastened by the catastrophe, that they're trying harder, that the banks are under greater scrutiny, but they're so complex, they're so vast, they're so powerful, they're so determined, frankly, to fight regulation, that I don't take any confidence from his statement at all.
Okay, so let's talk about how this works in Congress. I mean, what James Gorman, CEO of Morgan Stanley, is telling Charlie Rose there this month is that a process took place in Washington. I suspect he's talking about the Dodd-Frank regulatory scheme that was passed in the wake of the Great Recession, that regulators got together, Congress got together, fixed this system. The way you saw that come down as someone who watched that system happen, what do you think really happened?
Well, we didn't do nearly enough. We didn't do any structural reform of the banking system in statute. I mean, what happened after the Great Depression, or after the great stock market crash of 29, was that Congress passed the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated commercial from investment banking and insured the federal deposits of commercial banks. But Congress repealed that act in 1999, deregulated, never regulated derivatives. And so what should have happened in Congress was we should have done in statute something structurally to reduce the size and the leverage that these gigantic mega banks, which are even larger today than they were before the crisis, could undertake. Instead, Dodd-Frank is a very weak law. I mean, it's not even a law in the way we think of a law. It's a series of hundreds of instructions to regulators to write rules. And most of those rules haven't been implemented.
And the writing of the rules is the subject of what lobbyists do. They have input into that process.
Absolutely. And the big banks have fought with a ferocity that is really quite remarkable. I mean, on the one hand, they're saying in interviews, you know, everything's fine, you know, there's transparency with the regulators. On the other hand, they have an army of lawyers in Washington who are going into these regulatory agencies, helping to write these rules in a way that have loopholes. I mean, we just heard in the Wall Street Journal today that the Volcker Rule, which might have been the one good thing, you know, in Dodd-Frank, even though it itself had been watered down in its final form, may turn out to be a 900-page rule. I don't understand that. I don't understand how regulators can take what are admittedly already complex ideas and then make them even more complex by writing reams and reams of pages of rules. So we should have broken up the banks.
But that's a message that has an uphill battle against the Democrats that really were responsible for the deregulations in the 90s. Chris Dodd, in some ways, is a part of the team that got rid of Glass-Steagall during the Clinton administration. When it came time to think about putting that back on, he wanted nothing whatsoever to do with it. Do you think Chris Dodd has a moral leg to stand on, looking back at the act that has his name on it?
Well, it's not just him. It's also the Obama administration. I mean, the first draft of a working paper of what the Dodd-Frank bill ultimately would look like was done by Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and officials within the Obama administration. And when that white paper came out, it was marginal changes to the existing financial regulatory system. Chris Dodd himself said just a few days ago that he isn't confident that too big to fail has been dealt with effectively. Jack Lew, the Treasury Secretary, has said if we don't have rules implemented by the end of this year which allow us to say with a straight face, his words, that we have ended too big to fail, then we may have to contemplate additional solutions.
What's your experience in Washington in all of this that you found most disillusioning, heartbreaking about a process that you really believed in when you were a wide-eyed acolyte of then-Senator Joe Biden?
During my 20-year career in Washington, the amount of money that corporations spend in Washington, in particular Wall Street, more than tripled. And the plain fact of the matter is, you know, there is so much money to be made by both future and former public servants that I believe it skews outcomes. So you want to think that public officials will work for the taxpayer and be independent and act with integrity while they're in government and do the right thing. But it too often is the case that there's a big Christmas present sitting at the foot of the bed when they're finished with their public service. And to the tune of millions of dollars of booty in private practice.
Well, Christmas came early this year, that's for sure. Jeff Conniton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeff Conniton is a former lobbyist, White House lawyer, and Senate aide. He's the author of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
So how much credibility does that editorial by Vladimir Putin in the New York Times have in Washington as the debate over Syria continues? Members of Congress returned to work on Wednesday, and we found one who sounded a little relieved that President Obama had called off a vote on military action. But questions remain. Joining us now is Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez. Congresswoman Sanchez represents California's 46th congressional district. Congresswoman Sanchez, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
So I gather last week you probably thought your first couple of days at work were going to be all about an impending vote. Now what are you thinking?
Well, I'm as optimistic as I hope everybody is to try to find a solution to this crisis with diplomatic efforts. Our real concern has been, of course, to isolate these chemical weapons and take them out of the hands of Syria and its regime. So if we can do that without firing a weapon, that would be great.
Have you made up your mind how you would respond on a military strike based on what the president has already said?
I think that the president has not made the case that this is an imminent threat to us or to our country, and I would also add that he has really not gone to the UN and asked for a resolution on use of force, and so at this point, I would be leaning no with respect to going and doing an aggressive attack against Syria.
Did you manage to check out this Vladimir Putin editorial in the New York Times today?
Yes, actually, I woke up to it this morning.
How did you respond?
Well, certainly one of the arguments that I've been making is, where is the legal framework? How can we go in on our own and do this when even the UK is very hesitant to support us with force? So it would be unilateral. It would be without a UN resolution. The president has already admitted that we are not under imminent attack or have not been attacked. So I think you really put the UN charter at risk here. So I would agree with that point. I mean, I wouldn't agree with some of the other points he makes in there, as if, you know, he has been such a democratic leader or has not made aggressive behavior into other areas. But on the fine point of, you know, how do we get here and why do we have to use every other means before we get to war is a very important one.
What did you think of his point that it will destabilize the region, actually make it more likely for there to be war between Israel and the Palestinians, might escalate the conflict, and that the so-called freedom fighters don't really have much of an interest in democracy?
Well, the reality is that now over 2 years of war, there are a lot of foreign interests in there. There are many enemies, if you will, to the United States and what we stand for. And so on that point, I would agree. I believe that when you fire a shot, and I've said this, when you fire a shot in there, even if it's just a limited attack, we have put ourselves at the risk of being within the Syrian civil war. And there are many, many players on the sidelines that would love a reason to get into this and escalate this into a regional conflict.
Well, you've certainly noted that Vladimir Putin doesn't have much credibility as a Democrat or as some sort of freedom fighter. But nevertheless, his arguments seem to be making their way around Capitol Hill, and that's a shocker.
Again, when we send in weapons, as my husband, a retired colonel from the U.S. Army, said to me, our military is never a surgical instrument. It is always a sledgehammer, so there will be collateral damage of innocent civilians. So anything that can de-escalate that, anywhere that we can, you know, put in a notch where the U.N. can move forward as a body and actually have helped in the situation of de-escalating war, I think is a very positive for mankind. And if Putin gets to take credit on that, you know, well, good for him.
Strange times we're living in, that's for sure. Congresswoman, thanks so much.
Thank you so very much.
Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez is a Democrat from California's 46th district. She's the second highest ranking Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And this week we've been thinking about the implications of a planet that will soon have 10 billion people. In Africa, where the population stands today at more than 1 billion, making it the second most populous continent, efforts are being made to better manage family planning. It's a delicate process balancing practical realities against religion and culture, and each place is different. Anders Kelto, Africa correspondent for PRI's The World, recently completed a three-part series for his program called Family Choices, Fertility and Infertility in Africa.
You see a lot of variety from country to country, and you see a lot of variety in both the challenges and the successes. You find countries like Ethiopia, where the government is fully gotten behind initiatives to reduce family size and to encourage women to have fewer children. Basically, what they've done is they've put two what they call health extension workers in every single village in the country, no matter how small. And these two health workers, among other things, distribute free contraception to women and provide sort of counseling and just advice on how to properly space their pregnancies. And that's had a really dramatic effect. They've started to see the birth rate in the country fall. They've started to see infant mortality rates fall. One woman that I spoke to named Nea Ghosh lives in a village called Addis Zemen, which is in the northern part of Ethiopia. And she told me that the program has really started to change the attitudes of her neighbors and people in her village. And this is what she told me.
Large families used to be admired, but now it's people who use birth control and only have a few children who are respected.
So that's certainly a sign of change. Let's move on to Kenya, where the situation is far more fraught with fear and emotion than it is in Ethiopia, it seems, from your investigation.
Yeah, what I found in Kenya is that this whole idea of contraception and family planning is seen as a woman's issue in many parts of Kenya. It's not something that men want to be bothered with. It's not something that they're often comfortable talking about. So women are sort of left to do all the legwork. And what's worse is that men often want to have a lot of kids because it's a source of pride or even a source of wealth, a source of extra labor. But often men aren't willing to provide financially for their own children. I spoke with a woman at this clinic named Josephine, and this is what she told me about her husband.
He wants two more children, but he doesn't make much money, and he doesn't pay for anything. Even when the kids are sick, he doesn't give me money for the doctor.
And so the situation in Kenya is often one where women get on birth control secretly.
So, Anders, what support do women get from men in Kenya, if at all?
Well, there's some organizations that are trying to change men's attitudes about family planning and about family size. They have male health workers that go around their communities and organize events like soccer matches, you know, the types of events that tend to attract men. And they hand out information. They talk to them about the benefits of being responsible for their family's health. In South Africa and Africa generally, we often hear that women are having too many kids. But Africa also has the opposite problem in that a lot of women are infertile. In fact, infertility rates in some parts of Africa are very, very high, perhaps among the highest in the world. And infertility has serious consequences anywhere, but those consequences are especially bad in Africa. Women who cannot have children are more likely to end up living in poverty, often because their husbands leave them. They aren't allowed to have land. They can't inherit their husband's wealth. And so in South Africa, I spoke with a doctor named Silke Dyer, who studies infertility in Africa. And she told me that some infertile women are even shamed when they die.
And I think the worst issue of the dignity in death comes from reports from East Africa, where infertile couples, particularly women, would not be buried in community soil because there was concern that that would affect the fertility of the soil, and they would be left to decay in the woods.
Fortunately, Dr. Dyer, who you just heard, is running a clinic in Cape Town. It's one of the very few in Africa that offers in vitro fertilization and other reproductive therapies to low-income couples. So there's a type of in vitro fertilization that's available for a fraction of the cost of what it would be in the private sector.
Anders Kelto's three-part series for the world on family planning issues in Africa went to Ethiopia, Kenya, and South Africa. Anders Kelto, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
There's just too many of us. When LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, said this back in the 1960s, he thought a planet of about 3 billion people was crowded.
I will seek new ways to use our knowledge to help deal with the explosion in world population.
But by the time Richard Nixon left office, we were at 4 billion.
Our cities are going to be choked with people. They're going to be choked with traffic. They're going to be choked with crime.
Well, we already know that. Yesterday on our program, scientist Stephen Emmett tried to portray the steep rise in population that will get us to 10 billion people on planet Earth by the end of this century. He gave us measurements of food demand, CO2, pollution, and climate. Emmett makes the argument that the planet simply can't take this growth in humans. Danny Dorling is the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford and the author of Population 10 Billion. He says, in fact, the planet may be built especially to take these kinds of population loads. He joins me today from Oxford, England. Welcome, Danny.
Hello there.
So the argument from Stephen yesterday was really a stop or else catastrophe is going to happen. What I wanted to do was pose to you maybe a slightly more nuanced question of what can the planet actually take? Do we know?
We don't know. We've always had concerns that there is an optimum population, a top number. But a century ago, that top number, the top number people said that, for instance, the USA could take was about 100 million people. And of course, you've well expanded past that. We do not know what the number it could take is. But what we do know, the kind of really good news story, is that for 40 years now, our population growth has been slowing. The rate at which we're increasing, the number of extra babies we're having, has been slowing down for 40 years. So the growth is coming to an end. It's set to plateau at about 10 or 11 billion people. Most people in the world at the moment have 3 children on average, and their children are expected to have 2. This is the first population stability we'll be getting for centuries. And it's great news that it's coming.
Well, what is the planet going to do with the 10 billion? I mean, if it is the case that 10 billion is the plateau, it still doesn't answer the question of can we take all those people?
It's not necessarily the people. It's what the people do. The planet couldn't cope with just 1 billion people behaving very, very badly. The planet could cope with 10 or even more billion people if those people were not consuming resources and producing pollution at an unsustainable rate. It's not the number of people, it's what the people do. But the number of people slowing down helps. It's easier for a population that isn't endlessly growing to behave in a better way, not to burn so much oil, not to do so many things that are so destructive to our environment that our children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren will find it much harder to survive.
Can the planet sustain a doubling of demand for agricultural land that Stephen Emmett says needs to happen between now and 2050?
Well, we're not getting a doubling of population, so we'll only get a doubling of demand if people want to eat more. It can't sustain everybody eating the amount of meat that people in the rich world currently eat. It takes an enormous amount of land to produce that much meat. But eating meat just once or twice a week is far better for you than eating meat every day. So the planet can't sustain us being stupid. It can't sustain us being greedy. It can't sustain us carry on doing things that make us unhealthy, particularly in very large numbers, more of us doing that. But the planet can certainly house a population of 10 billion people who spend most of their time not eating meat, but who eat meat occasionally.
Now, what is it that's going to induce these changes in behaviors? Huge population fall-offs in places where unsustainability becomes famine? Is it going to be, you know, entertaining PowerPoint presentations by former vice presidents? I mean, what is it that's going to cause?
It's already begun. It began around 1971. That was the peak year population growth. The growth then was 2.3% a year, completely unsustainable. And the growth has begun. The growth rate has begun to slow since then. We're not sure what the cause was, but the cause happened. There's a whole combination of things. There's birth control. There's the increased power of women, which seems more and more important the more we look at it. So women getting a voice in society and begin to say, no, they don't want to have three or four children. But the key thing is you shouldn't despair. It's not what will we have to do. Something has already happened to mean that in 1971, we began to have slightly fewer children than in 1970, fewer again for 40 years. It has begun. We're not sure why it has begun, but it wasn't PowerPoint presentations, it wasn't great leaders, and it's happened all around the world. So now over half of the world has below fertility replacement already, and the rest is slowing to that very, very rapidly.
Finally, is there a scenario which might produce a population reversal like we saw in the Middle Ages, either disease, pathogens, or loss of access to clean water?
Yes, there are lots of very bad scenarios, scenarios of war, scenarios of famine. And the sad thing is all those scenarios don't actually result in fewer people. They end up resulting in more people. So after a war, you get a baby boom and a big population explosion. After famine or an epidemic, you have more babies. So we need to watch out for things getting much worse. Large numbers of people dying won't make us better off. They'll actually result in us having more children and it becoming more unsustainable. We need a stable planet. We need to look after each other.
Is a resilient planet something we should be happy about or something that encourages bad behavior before we go?
We don't know how resilient the planet is. But what we do know is that human beings are entering a new period. We have never before had the majority of the world's population living in cities or in these numbers. We don't know how resilient we are to this, and we need to worry about ourselves and how we behave, and certainly damaging the planet is not going to help ourselves.
Danny Darling is a professor of geography at the University of Oxford, author of Population 10 Billion. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from a lot of you about family size. What factors did you weigh in deciding how many children to have?
I had two children, both of whom are grown. It was late 60s and zero population growth. The ZPG movement was big. So most of my friends had just two children. That was the responsible thing to do.
Responsible thing to do. How are you adapting? Thanks to Diane from California there. But you and Eugene, Oregon, aren't quite ready to stop reproducing. You're right. I have three terrific grown kids. I wanted as many kids as possible, up to six. Got halfway there. I'm 60 and I'd still have more. If you've ever lived in Eugene, it's a lovely place for kids, that's for sure. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Sometime during the Cold War, the president became, in part, defined as the guy who carried around the nuclear launch codes in case of global thermonuclear war. In the launch code case were the launch codes and instructions of where to go, who would lead, and how would a new government be set up, its rules to be enforced by the secret military elite. It's what you see in lots of disaster movies, protocols, command bunkers, undisclosed locations. The United States of Doomsday is not just a place in the movies, though. It exists in detailed plans drawn up by shadow government officials who are planning for the worst, but who have ended up creating, according to journalist and military analyst William Arkin, a start tomorrow top secret emergency government ready to step in and take control at a moment's notice. William Arkin is the author of the new book, American Coup, How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution. Only in America, Arkin says, would you find U.S. government officials with jobs to write detailed secret rules for taking over their own government, a kind of in-case-of-emergency, destroy-democracy program, all paid for by U.S. taxpayers.
There are 48 presidential emergency active directives sitting in envelopes, more highly classified than anything that Edward Snowden ever got his hands on, that essentially are both pre-written legislation and pre-written authorizations and executive orders, giving to a set of people who we don't know, who have not been elected and have not been confirmed by the Senate, a set of powers should X happen, where X is not even specified, to take over the country. And these are all nameless, faceless, unelected, unconfirmed careerists in the military.
Who can veto the president and Congress, or that somehow the elected government is beholden to on a day-to-day basis?
I'm not sure veto is the right word, but they are the president and the Congress and the elected government when a disaster occurs. In other words, they've got actual orders in envelopes in their safes that say, if Washington is destroyed, you're the Secretary of Defense. So that would be martial law, but it's in this unique design of an American coup that avoids any stain of a military takeover, but yet at the same time is like a much more encompassing takeover that indeed includes the public and private sector, and that's interesting, and also at the same time erodes the power of the states and the local community in terms of their ability to reconstitute a United States. I mean, the federal government didn't invent the states. The states created a union, and the union created a federal government. So in theory, if there were a gigantic catastrophe in Washington, D.C., you would depend upon the governors of the states that are surviving to reconstitute the government. Well, we're exactly in the opposite, which is to say that some set of bureaucrats are going to take over, brush the governors aside, brush the states aside, brush the local authorities aside, and say, as Alexander Haig said in 1981, as of now, I am in charge here.
Do these people know who they are? I mean, is there somebody in Washington who knows I'm the president if there's like a really bad storm?
I imagine the answer to that question is yes. But one of the things I discovered in doing my work is there are already three presidents. We call it the football. The football was the briefcase.
The launch codes.
That contained the launch codes that accompanied the president everywhere. And the football was this venerable object that we kind of thought about as representing, you know, the epicenter of the nuclear era. Well, you know, the football is not just the launch codes anymore. It's a huge trial bag filled with all sorts of electronic gizmos and all sorts of plans and operations and digital documents. And now there are three. There's one with the president since 9/11. There's one with the vice president. And there's also one with the Secretary of Defense. Well, you know, again, you could say, well, that all makes sense. But on the other hand, the Secretary of Defense is sixth in line to be the president of the United States in the Constitution. So the idea that somehow the Secretary of Defense is third, in my mind, that already erodes the Constitution, because you already see that they're cutting corners in their day-to-day operations to say, you know what, we're not going to follow the Constitution or the law in dealing with an emergency. We've already got it covered.
Final question. If this should be implemented, if there ever were an emergency that would cause all of those classified documents to be opened, do you see essentially a conflict between this federal parallel government and the local authorities that would be trying to handle the emergency on their own?
There's two problems I see. One, not only do we have an emergency apparatus which has an enormous amount of influence and control today on a day-to-day basis, because it's not just preparing for that one eventual doomsday, but also at the same time we're changing the nature of the relationship between the federal government and the states and the local community. We're doing it by pushing the state governments to build national security apparatuses –
So every state now has a Homeland Security Department. Every state now has an intelligence fusion center. Every police department says that they're doing intelligence-led policing, which includes license plate readers and drones and everything else. If all of a sudden everything becomes homogenized and national, then the very premise of America, which is that law enforcement is a local power and that the federal government can't infringe upon the rights of the states, begins to erode. And it's happening right now.
William Arkin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
William Arkin is the author of the new book, American Coup: How a Terrified Government is Destroying the Constitution. You know, I'd love to find one of those launch code footballs just sitting around, you know. Forget all those annoying campaigns. I'll just be the government. My laptop. I'll take care of all of you. Really. Let's talk about family planning, okay? How big of a family should you have, all of you organized people who plan things perfectly? Poof. My wife and I got 5 kids. We weren't exactly planning for that. 5 Hockenberry kids in a world of 10 billion. All this hour, you've been talking about the decisions you've made when it comes to the size of your families. How big is your family? From Anoka, Minnesota, you write, "We have twins. We considered the fact that we wanted at least one child, and that was about it. It wasn't about costs or the world that they would come into. Let's have one and just go from there." And we got 2. Congratulations. We got 2 sets of twins and had the same kind of feeling. Oh, this is great. Changes over time, but you can call us back with more stories. From Jacksonville Beach, Florida, "We're a family of 4, my husband and 2 kids. I never gave much thought to how many kids I planned to have, as I didn't plan either of them. The kids worked out very well, all things considered. They're wonderful human beings."
My name is Stephanie. I'm calling from Jacksonville, Florida. And my husband and I have only 1 child. We would love to have more, but with both of us working and the fact that we don't have any family closer than 3 hours away, saving for retirement, saving for college, may just have to be the one.
Hi, this is Stu in Seattle. I'm 42 and single with no children and never planned to father any. This world is overpopulated and I cannot in good conscience bring any new lives into it.
Thanks, Stu, but if we're in Seattle, could you stop by maybe and watch our kids maybe for a couple of hours? Sarah agrees to a point. She writes on Facebook, "My husband and I had only 1 and planned it that way because the world is so overpopulated, it just fits our lifestyle. If we want another later, we would adopt." We'd love to know what you think. If you want to be a part of our conversation, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.